signal. Good afternoon. This is Loretta Bertolot at the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum. The date is May 11th, 2022. And I'm here with a gorgeous actress singer and really looking forward to this interview. Will you introduce yourself with your name, your maiden name, and your birthday?
Okay. I am Melanie Klarman, K-L-A-R-M-A-N. I never use that name. Fry, F-R-Y. I am 70 years old, and I'm very lucky to have been, very privileged to be have been asked to do this.
Okay, and I asked Melanie, actually Gail Campbell's here with us, and Gail knows Melanie from different productions
in town. When she was a child.
And so we were going to talk about her professional career, and I found out that she has many professions as we go.
I'm just looking at that, just to be looking.
That's the seconds. So, Melanie, why don't we start with how your family came to Tulsa? Just
okay.
Briefly about that.
Okay. Dad was from, he was born 1921. He was from a family of Hungarians. He was the only boy in an Orthodox Jewish family of five children. They immigrated to the United States at the turn of the last century, 1910 or something like that. My dad was born in 1921. He was in the military and played professional, semi-professional sports. I think he was playing with the Air Force at that time because I know he played in the Cotton Bowl. But anyway, they passed through here. He'd grown up in Brooklyn, which is where the family had settled. And I found out that I'm my dad's daughter. I don't like lots of stimuli, big cities, lots of noise and stuff. And my dad didn't either. He came through Tulsa and he was like, hey, this is, you know, I kind of like it here. So he settled here with a friend in 1947 or 48 after the war, and was going to ask somebody out that he'd already been out with and got a wrong number, and it was my mother. So they ended up dating, and they never should have been married, but they did, and had two kids, and they lived in Tulsa, and I was born and raised here pretty much.
Okay.
Not born here, but I came here at age 6 weeks. My dad was in the reserves and at McAllister at the ammo dump there. Got called up to Korea, sustained extraordinary moral wounds, PTSD that was never treated. So that affected pretty much everything.
So did he serve in World War II and Korea?
Uh-huh, he did. He joined the reserves thinking, oh, this is a little bit of extra income, you know, I can do for my family, and boom, Korea went to war, and he got called up and went up. He was the only survivor of his platoon. And so I know that he experienced, he would never talk about it, of course, you know, anyway, that's mm-hmm. how Dad came to town. And then Mom, her family was from Texas and Arkansas and Oklahoma, and her grandfather was in the Ku Klux Klan. So culture clashes. My mother's from Oklahoma Hillbillies, Dad's from Orthodox Jews from Hungary. Hey, let's get married and have kids. So that's what they did.
All right. Well, I was kind of surprised when you walked in today how you introduced yourself. You said you were from the north side.
Yep.
And
grew up over by the airport, went to Hamilton Junior High. It was a junior high back then. And John Ross, which is, I don't even know if people remember John Ross. It's
Indian.
Yeah, but
Native American.
Yeah. But
oh, the school.
The
yeah.
school. At one time it was a four-room schoolhouse, and the year after they built the new school, I was a kindergartner there. But yeah, we lived over by the airport for a long time, and you know, that area of Tulsa, that area was built for veterans. They were built for people who had been in the war and their families and all this other stuff. And looking back at that at age 70, looking back 60, 65 years, pretty much everybody in that neighborhood that was a guy had fought in World War II and had PTSD. They were not right in the head from think about these kids that went over there to fight the war. So anyway, there were a lot of suicide attempts, a lot of domestic violence, a lot of alcoholism, things like that in the neighborhood. And not in my family, thank God. There was some abuse and some violence and stuff, but that's the way my parents were raised. So they were like, man, this is fine. This is the way you raise kids. You smack them around. They didn't know.
Which high school did you graduate from?
Graduated from Hale, Nathan Hale, class of 69, a very unpopular in school. I was pretty much cast out because I was overweight And I was Jewish, half Jewish, and I was a pimple-faced teenager and just really had no sense of self, no sense of self-esteem, no sense of identity. Just, I don't know what, you know, just really nothing. Yeah, just kind of surviving, I guess. And then eventually had a very nice nervous breakdown and a suicide attempt at age 19 because of all the bullying I had endured at school and at home. And spent a year in Oklahoma City at University Hospital in a unit called 5E. And for the first time in my life, I had somebody listen to me and hear what I had to say. That had never happened before, you know? So that was a big deal, big turning point in my life. And you probably, I'm tearful in case you can't tell from my voice. Eventually became an actress, but also eventually became a therapist because I have so much experience with mental health issues of my own and my family and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I'm very drawn to the helping professions. I'm very much an empath. And I really like being a therapist. I think, I'm not saying I know what I'm doing, but I think I'm okay at it.
Well, good. I think someone who's been through some of that would have a lot of empathy with their patients.
I think the wounded healers are the people that really know how to heal, you know, because they've experienced that. I got sober 20 years ago, and that was all, you know, because when you go through a lot of stuff in life, you know, you try and self-medicate, you know, join religions, and you do things to soothe that pain. And that's what I did. So anyway, I drank and among other things, I didn't do heavy drugs or anything like that, but I needed to get sober and because my mother was ill and I needed to grow up. That was at age 50 and I took too long to grow up, I think. If I had it to do over, I would make very different choices in my life.
Wouldn't we all?
Yeah.
I don't know. Some people are like, I'm really, really happy with what I have. And I know I've made so many mistakes and I have so many regrets that I would give anything to be able to go back in a lot of areas. Not all, but most.
Well, let's go back a few years to your professional...
pardon me, I'm blowing my nose.
Okay, so let's talk about your theater and musical career.
Okay. Age 14, went to my very first big audition, which was at the Spotlight Theater down on Riverside, and auditioned for My Fair Lady with a group called Tulsa Youth Group Theater. And a whole bunch of people were in that group that I'm still friends with at age 14. I mean, I was still maintaining those friendships and stuff. And this is what's weird. My best friend, her name was Mary Margaret Murda. And Mary Margaret and I, Mary looked as gorgeous. She looked like Elizabeth Taylor, but she'd had a weight problem, lost weight. I was still very heavy. And so we became friends, and she was lovely, loved her, went to Edison graduate. You probably went to school with some Murdas, M-U-R-T-A. And eventually, I didn't lose track of her, but you know, life got in the way and she had kids and blah, blah, blah. So about 15, 20 years ago, I was driving through Missouri and wanted to stay with them, you know, because I hadn't seen her in so long. I was going to Detroit to do a show up there. And I go through their house, I'm like, what the hell, you guys are nuts? What? There are pictures of Garth Brooks everywhere. What? And you've got Go Records. What is the deal? And she said, oh, that's Mike's brother. So that's her brother-in-law. She married Garth Brooks' brother. And if anybody wants to know about Garth Brooks from a personal standpoint, he is a star in personal life, too. He's a good, good man. So that's how I got started in the theater and then took a little hiatus for a nervous breakdown and went back to school. I got free schooling because of that hospitalization, that year-long hospitalization. I got Milk Rehab and went to school and knew when I was hospitalizing, the only thing that was there, and I've always been a reader, was a medical library. We were on a locked ward, so we couldn't get out. So I read every damn book in that medical library on psychiatry. And by the time I got out of school, I'm like acing my psych classes and stuff. So that was pretty easy. So I went, since that school was being paid for and I had the option to continue, I got a master's, which I never used, because the day after I got that master's, I auditioned for the American Theater Company, and the rest is history. So I put that on the back burner for 35 years and performed because I was cast in a show called Joyce Martell at the Brook Theater, and that kind of put the theater and me and everybody in that show kind of in the public spotlight, which I was really unprepared for. Just really messed with my head. Of course, everything messed with my head back then.
Tell about Joyce's personality, her role in that.
The way she was described to me is she was the underground queen of country western, rock and roll, disco, very much like stupid hicks. I mean, not clever, dumb hick people. So I was supposed to look like Dolly Parton. So speaking of which, by the way, you know, I grew up as an overweight kid. I lost all this weight right after I got out of the hospital and married Dennis Frye. That's where I got my name. Dennis Frye is the finest human being on the planet. He's a wonderful human being. But I lost a bunch of weight, thank God, because I had to wear these little bitty costumes. And so for the next 30 years, I was kind of mean because I couldn't eat what I wanted to eat and stuff. So anyway, got cast actually in a show called Hotel Baltimore. That was the first show I did with them. I got cast on something before that. The very first show at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center that currently sits at 2nd and Cincinnati, the American Theater Company had the first production in there, the show called Ms. Raccoon's Profession. Ms. Raccoon's Profession, it was actually about Katie Westby and the patrons of the arts at that time.
Oh, yes.
So it was a parody on that, and they had written a show also called Oh Tulsa, which was a statement about racism and oil money. And it was just, it was shocking for its day, very shocking. So the American Theater Company was very edgy, very cutting edge, and yet, since it was started by a group of four TU students, they had been trained classically. I had zero training in theater, and so they trained us classically. So I got a very good theater education there back in, you know, the early 80s, late 70s. Because I had a husband that worked, thank God, and that allowed me to participate and do theater. So I owe Dennis Frye a lot for those years. He worked, I played, and it was
okay.
Great.
Who were the four people that started that group?
Kitty Roberts, Jerry Pope, Jim Runyon, Bob Odell, and then there was a fifth, Richard Ellis, that would move in and out. And Richard Ellis now pretty much runs the theater. He's still living and kicking. He's probably one of the best scenic designers on earth. He's unbelievably talented. I mean, he's designed for Radio City and Paul Newman and all that stuff.
This is all this Tulsa talent.
I was watching The Gilded Age the other day, and there are three people in there from Tulsa, one of whom I've worked with, Jeannie Triplehorn. When she was 12, we did Christmas Carol together, and Greg Rhodes drove her home, and he said, "What do you want to be when you grow up? And she said, "I want to be a movie star."
And she is.
She is. Went to Juilliard and everything. So anyway, a lot of talent here.
Yes, yes. And I've interviewed Bob Odell, who's teaching school.
He's retired now.
Did he retire?
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's been a couple of years. So you were quite several years at ATC then.
I'm still with them. I'm on their board.
Okay. All right. So what are some other branches of your performances you've gone to?
In the late 90s, I've only had a couple of real jobs because I'm not wired for them at all. But I have. And I quit a job. I was the City of Tulsa's fine arts coordinator for 7 years. And it was not a match. It was not a good match. But after that, I had done Honky Tonk Angels here in town. American Theater Company had brought in Ted Swinley, who was the playwright of that show.
Mm-hmm.
And we just really hit it off. We had a really good time and stuff. So he picked me up, and I toured with him for like 3 or 4 years, different shows, different places. Mainly summer stock, but I, you know, California. I got to see the world pretty much with that. It was a lot of fun. And then my mom got sick with dementia. And that's when I knew I had to stop doing that. I had to grow up, get sober, and get a real job that day. And I did. So that was about 20 years ago. Not only did I get sober that year, I went back to school at OU and got a second master's degree in psychology, and got that I think in about 9 months or a year, something like that. did my internship and became a licensed professional counselor. So that's what I do now. I'm a psychotherapist, and I really like what I do. But I like acting, too. I'm taking film classes now, acting classes, because I'm trying to make that leap.
Still in the business. Okay, what about the Pops?
The what?
The Pops. You were with the Pops?
Theater Pops.
Yeah, that was Randy Whalen. And actually, ATC absorbed them. Randy died about 8 years ago, maybe 10, something like that. When he died, ATC sort of absorbed that theater company. It was actually started, I think, by David Balla. I believe he started that. Anyway, so we've got a couple of their board members, a couple of their actors and stuff. So they still live through the American Theater Company.
Okay. And what about I have Tulsa Project Theater?
I think they're inactive right now, but I did a couple of shows with them. Theater Tulsa, I've done, every time I get fired from the American Theater Company, I either go to Theater Tulsa or Tulsa Alliance for Classical Theater.
What do you mean every time you'd get fired?
I was a little bit of a discipline problem. I did not have that mental health issue quite managed like it is now. And I was hard to work with a lot of times. It was easy if it was going my way, and if it wasn't going my way, I like to make trouble. So they kept firing me, and then I'd say, I'm better, or we need you. You know, they say we need you or whatever. I'd go back. Now I can say they can probably hire me again. I'd be okay. But back in the day, it was just, I had no idea how to deal with this. With being on TV once a week or in the paper once a week, it just was mind-boggling to me. I couldn't, now I could deal with it, but back then it was just, what happened, you know? So yeah, I toured a lot with theater. I've done, gotten a lot of training. Trained with Second City in Chicago, trained with Chicago City Limits, which is Second City, but they're in New York. Trained with them. Currently in film and acting classes to make the transition to film, which I'm really working hard at because theater is so different. And film,
where do you take those?
So
at TU?
No, there are a couple of really good theater teachers here. Let me back up. Oklahoma has given the film industry a lot of tax breaks, a lot of legislation that helps them. Just a lot of the tribes, too, have given a lot of tax breaks and funding and all this other stuff. So Oklahoma is real up and coming in the film world now, of all things to think of. I mean, just believe me. I never thought I would see this happen. So what has happened is actors from California and New York are moving to Tulsa because there's so much work here. It's like what happened in Atlanta with Tyler Perry and Real Housewives. And there's a whole film community there because of them. There's one in Chicago. And Tulsa is now the fifth or sixth behind Austin. As far as film production, and I mean, it's just, in fact, there's a couple or several people bought the Cox Center in Oklahoma City, which is bigger than our Cox Center here. They bought it, and now it's all sound stages, you know, recording, practice rooms. Incredible. I mean, it's just unbelievable what's happening here. So I'm taking film classes because I haven't done a show in probably 15 years, and I'm thinking, I need something to do in my retirement. I'm still in private practice, but I really want to try.
Great. I mean, there's always another transition as things move along, the the groups or the media forms or whatever's coming up. Mm-hmm. Have we missed any of the local groups that you've performed with?
Well, before we move on, talk about Eddie a little bit.
Oh,
Eddie was
that was her favorite. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So apart from Joyce Martel, which was very blue, very naughty, very adult entertainment, very cabaret style, we did a show called Eddie and the Eclectics, and Bob Bethel was Eddie. And Bob, his voice, I love him to this day. We're still very good friends. But I was a secondary player in that, which took all the pressure off of me. So I got to be a backup singer, and I was very happy doing that. So I got some good solos. But Eddie was a 1950s rock and roll show, very family-oriented, very clean, very just wholesome, you know. And we had a blast doing that show. I loved it. I like bringing kids from the audience and putting them on stage and let them dance and have fun and stuff. So, and I'm still in touch with a lot of those kids that we would bring up on stage, because a lot of those kids were like our costumers' kids and technician kids and stuff like that. And they're all grown, and none of them turned out to be psycho. They're all normal. We're so grateful because of the stuff we exposed them to. Oh my God. So all the kids are fine.
And I remember Eddie and the Eclectics being in the Brook Theater in Brookside. Is that the only was that their only venue?
We did. In fact, there's a book called Memories of the Old Lady that a friend of mine wrote, and it's about the Brady Theater. And we performed there for a few years. And Tyrone Wilkerson played Eddie. Bob would say stuff like, "Oh my God, I'm walking to the left. I can't do the show." And you're like, "What?" Or he'd come in and say, "I have a bone in my foot. I can't do the show." He just didn't want to do it anymore. So we got Tyrone. We got several Eddies. But yeah, we did it at, we did it at Cane's. I met my second husband at a show we did at Cane's. And then, yeah, but it was mainly the Brook, and to me, that was the perfect venue for it. It was just enough seats. It wasn't too crowded. It was, you know, and it was just so much fun. And I would lose like 10 pounds a night doing that show because you never, and I'd have to be in shape for it. I'd have to work out, you know, to be able to sing and dance at the same time for 3 hours.
It seemed like we got to dance in the aisles as we were watching the show.
Exactly. So you probably lost a lot of weight, too. It was so much fun, though. That was my favorite show to do. That was by far.
Everybody loved Eddie.
It was just so fun. It was just, it was a
great
good.
Cast.
I'd love to bring that back with a younger cast. Well, we did bring it back 3 years ago. We had a fundraiser for ATC, and I couldn't find singers, so I ended up doing it. And I'm looking at pictures, and I'm like, man, you look 65, but you are.
We have retro rockets now, but it's not the same.
It's different, yeah. I also stay in. I'm very active, always been very, very active, so I belong to a gym and stuff. But in the summer girls, we have a girlfriend who's got a pool at her house, and we play water volleyball, the girls do. And that has become, I have no family. They're all dead. I have no children that I know of. Just my girlfriends and stuff, and we are, you know, most of us are, some of us have boyfriends, some have kids, but they're out of town. You know, some of us are childless and not married. It's a mishmash. But we play water volleyball 3 times a week in the summer, and I'm telling you, that's my thing. I love that.
You're pretty aggressive with that?
I'm very aggressive. They hate me because I cuss and I'm mean and I make fun of them, but we have a good time.
Do you take the shallow end or the deep end?
I'm short. I take the shallow end.
Sounds fun. What else are you doing for fun these days? You're taking classes, you're playing water volleyball, you're working.
Hey, I'm putting together a couple of fundraisers. The best thing in my life that's happened so far recently is I live in a condominium and I share a deck. It's about a 15 square foot deck with a family next door. And that family, when they moved in, I didn't know this, but she was pregnant. And now there's an 18 month old over there who's my favorite baby in the world, Petey, my little sweetheart. And he's got a month old little sister who lives there now. So I have babies in my life, and I've turned into this friggin' meemaw. I mean, I go in the store, and the first thing I do is go to the baby stuff. It's terrible. So, yeah, I love spoiling kids, and I've got my little playmate over there, and I really, what a lucky break. Wow.
You keep turning the pages, Melanie.
Well, it's just, you know, it's all about, I started a senior co-housing community about 5 years ago, and John and Pat Orsalak are doing it. It's called Heartwood Commons, and what had happened was I knew I was aging, you know, and I knew I had no family and nobody to care for or care for me or anything like that. So I started putting friends together, you know, that I knew that we could serve each other. So I started doing some research and started doing a lot of research on aging and what it takes to age and age well. You know, it's not a, I mean, you can age and be 90, but you can be hooked up to 20 machines, you know, that crap. So I don't want. So what I discovered was senior co-housing, and what that is that there's usually a common house, usually 25 to 35 residences around it that are all connected. Everything is green. They usually have the heat.
Yeah, geothermal.
Yes, geothermal heat and all that, so it's self-sustaining. I dropped out because I got priced out of it. It's way too expensive for me now. But they're about to move in August. The group that I started, they are moving on it. It's built.
Is this the one south of 71st?
Yes, that's it. I started that.
Did you really?
I did. Me and my friend Janie. So then we got on some radio show to talk about it, and they said, "Hey, you want your own radio show?" And we're like, "Yeah." So we did a show called Aging Bull. This, because my thing is all about aging and aging well. So I started doing Blue Zone stuff, and I don't know if you knew this, Tulsa was going to be a Blue Zone's community, you know, with the mayor and OU, and people just lost interest. But the most important thing is you're aging. Yes, diet and exercise are really, really important, but the most important thing is community. It's being around other people. So we have game night, we play volleyball, you know, we're always, you know, we go to the show, we do all this other stuff, and that is what has made my older age really quality, very rich. Mm-hmm. Is
Anita Larson worked on that project too. Did you know Anita?
I think she must have come after.
She was a volunteer with us, but it just took a long time to do all the research get everything, all the pieces in.
Well, one of the reasons I dropped out is because everything is done by consensus, and I want my way. I like, I need to run the world.
That's the problem with the community's living, that you don't get to be the boss for
everything. Yeah. So I thought, if I'm going to build, I'm just going to build my own house. But but it is a good, I have many friends who are actually going to be living there. But my thing at this part of my life is all about other people. It's all about helping other people and opening doors for them and supporting them and all that stuff. So for me, the most important thing is learning about and maintaining information and knowledge about aging. Because I never thought I'd make it to 70. I really didn't. And I, you know, in very good health, thank God. But that's how you do that, is you stay in community, you know, you try and eat well or reasonably well and a little bit of exercise. But the most important thing is community. So I love having the babies next door and all that stuff. So I've got a great life.
And I will say, you're not heavy anymore. You're very trim and
thank
fit
you.
Looking.
Well, I had to start taking Otezla. That changed everything. I have plaque psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, and I started taking Otezla, and I mean, I don't have an appetite. It's been wonderful. Except you should see my Otezla. I wish I could get rid of that, but whatever.
Oh, well, a few more weights lifting sessions will do that.
So.
Sure. Can you get a little closer to the microphone, please?
I was just wondering about your brother. You didn't really talk about your brother. Would you be interested in talking about your brother?
Yeah, I know now. My brother was considered a little odd, and he was tormented in my family because neither one of us fit the mold. I was very creative and very outspoken and overweight and stuff, and so I had zero voice. Nobody wanted to hear from a fat young person, you know. My brother, I know now, you know, after I had been in a therapy, he had Asperger's. And there's no doubt about Asperger's. So we were four separate entities in a family. There were no alliances, there was nobody you could go to for support. It was just four people. So as soon as he graduated, you know, as soon as I graduated, I had a nervous breakdown. I told him to sit off. But as soon as he graduated, he went off and joined a religious cult in California, and estranged from my parents. And I was estranged from my parents for a long time too, just because it was just this weird dynamic. It was nobody's fault. It was just the way it worked. So now, forming alliances and bonds and stuff like that are really important to me because I'm just now learning how to do that, you know. So anyway, he was a savant. He could remember any baseball statistic from, you know, the year they started playing, but he had no people skills. He never dated. He never left, and he died about 3 years ago of basically inertia. He just sat for many, many years.
We're learning more and more about the Asperger's. Mm-hmm. What do you specialize in, any particular area in your therapy?
I do. Two special areas. Women over 55, my favorite. And my second one is angry men. And we just got a contract, I think, with the police officers, with the FOP, I think. And the reason I like angry men is because I myself had a little, it wasn't an anger problem, it was a rage problem. It was a lot about rage. And I've learned that anger, 100% of the time, comes from childhood trauma. It comes from anxiety. And so when somebody comes, you know, a male comes to me and, well, my wife said I've come because you deal with angry men. I said, it's not really anger. What I think sounds better is, and I think this is more appropriate, is you have an anxiety problem. It's anxiety. Nothing else. It's that. So let's have a look at that. And usually if there's an abusive parent in there, there's usually an abusive father or stepfather or mother who is chosen men over this child, and there's a lot of rage. And I get that. And I like working with it.
So working with the police, is this to help them with their personal problems or to help them in dealing with the public?
Probably both, I would imagine. I don't know a lot of police officers, but I know that at one time, very early on in my life, I thought, I want to be in law enforcement. I thought, God, I didn't do that. But I know that the very short period, there's a lot of anxiety involved in that, a lot of unknowing. There's a lot of angry men find their way to law enforcement, a lot of ex-military angry soldiers find their way to the military. And I worked with the military for 6-7 years and still work with them occasionally, just on deployments and redeployments. And, you know, just because when a person leaves home, I don't care if it's a male or female, they leave home for 6 months or a year, your family's not the same when you come back, especially if you've left a pregnant wife. And you come back and that wife has given birth, that baby doesn't know you, doesn't know your smell, doesn't know anything. And it's just a whole weird dynamic with. So my very first military assignment, we went to Colorado Springs at Fort Carson, and that group had come back from an 18-month deployment. Think about that. That's a year and a half for these young people. Hardly any marriages survived, you know, lots of affairs, lots of, you know, infidelity, just a lot of stuff. And so not a lot of, so our group told the military, the Department of Defense, I said, you can't, this is really unhealthy. It was awful to do these 18-month deployments. And now they cut them down to a year, and now I think they're 8 months, which I still think is too long, but whatever. I don't run the military. I should. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Like the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm good at that. I'm good at organizing.
Yeah. One of the things that I think may help them through that time at the time is that they can communicate now, which they couldn't do in previous wars. I mean, you know, they're on their cell phones and their laptops conversing back with their family in the States. So
it's true, but I always knew that if somebody said, oh, my husband's been deployed, or he's taken a deployment to Korea, because you volunteer for those, Korea is party time, you know, lots of affairs, lots of sex, lots of alcohol, stuff like that. I thought, it's gonna be hard. Because you don't know what's, and plus a lot of these kids, you know, right out of high school, they don't know shit. They don't know anything, you know? And so the first thing they do is get married and buy a truck. That's usually the first thing they do. Anyway.
Truck they can't afford.
That's exactly right.
Well, Melanie, you've been all over Tulsa. What do you think Tulsa still needs in the performing arts?
They need patronage. They need money. There are so many little theater companies in town, and I'm delighted that there are, but we all compete for the same grant monies, the same ticket holders, the same, you know, all that stuff. And I'm hoping that, you know, for years and years and years, people tried to consolidate. Katie Westby did, trying to consolidate all the theater companies into one lump. And I'm thinking that is not going to happen. First of all, I'm glad it's not going to happen. But I understand the logic behind it, because it is so expensive to put up a production. It's just incredible. I mean, look at the opera that Thad did. I mean, think of what he paid, what his budget was. God! So, you know, the Kaisers have changed the face of Tulsa. When I was growing up, Tulsa had no identity. We have an identity because of the Kaisers, I think, because of all the things that they've contributed with Educare and maternity, motherhood, and, you know, all child, all that stuff, and they've contributed to the arts and everything. So that, to me, has changed everything. I don't know that there is a solution for the arts in Tulsa, because of COVID, we've noticed that we have very few audience members, and people are used to watching their TVs with their families, you know, for $5 a month or whatever. So that's a real issue, is bringing people back to live theater.
What seems to work better, or is it just a mixture of local talent versus traveling units?
I get so pissed, because Tulsa has the talent. We have every bit as much talent as Broadway does, or LA, or what we do. That's just what we're a microcosm of both of those places. But we don't get anywhere because we don't have the names. We're not, you know, Sally Struthers, or, you know, even though she's not big, I replaced her one time, but on an opening night, which was nightmarish, because people were expecting Sally Struthers and they got me. It was not good. But anyway, I don't know that there is anything to do with local arts. The one thing I've seen a huge surge in is visual arts. Have you guys noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody's got a gallery, everybody's an artist, every old woman I know, me included, you know, we're trying to paint abstract, we're trying to, you know, you see all these older women artists, and usually we'll join a drumming group too. That's part of our manual, our old lady manual. But I'm just seeing a lot of people, and part of this has to do with, you know, I don't have anything to do, but part of it is self-expression. You know, these film classes are reminding me how much I miss ensemble performing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Visual art, of which I am, you know, I've had to, like, put together 5 art shows, the women's art shows, and all that other stuff, big endeavors. But I've noticed that, where was I headed with that? I don't even know. Anyway, visual arts now seem to be really everywhere, a lot more than performance. But which is, you know, I still have a studio set up in my house. I mean, I haven't done any art in probably a year. I've just been busy with babies and stuff, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm having a really good time.
But so art's everywhere, but do we have enough art shows that they're able to make
sell?
Yeah, to sell.
No. Okay. I don't think there are maybe 5 or 6 artists in Tulsa that might be visual artists that are earning their living doing that. And in Tulsa, you know, if you're a performing artist, this was just my sad song that I sang for years. You can't get work here. You cannot get paid. You have to go where the work is, where it pays. And I would never do that because I don't like
there's no living wage here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not if you're a performer. You might be able to do something now in film, you know, but technicians always work and they always get paid. Actors always work and they don't get paid. So I hope that changes.
I'm going to tuck this little statement in. This week we did open the Bob Dylan Museum,
which
was sponsored by the Kaiser Foundation that bought it. Yeah.
So, they're amazing.
Yeah.
They have brought us into the world of the living and to the 21st century, which is where, you know, in his remote Tulsa program, bringing people in, seeding the city with these brilliant young people, or even older people. One of my girlfriends, her boyfriend, 75.
Oh, their professional offices, is that what you're talking about?
No, a remote Tulsa is, Kaisers are bringing people in from all over the country for $10,000 to move here.
Okay, that's what I meant. Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And they move here and work for a year or whatever?
At least, yeah, they work remotely. My friend Jane, she and her boyfriend are volunteers at the Dylan Center. He is a published writer. He's got a Wikipedia page and all this other. He's a really cool guy. They are volunteers, and he is a Tulsa remote person. He's 70 feet your age. He's 75. And he's loving it. He loves Tulsa. He really does. But if you'd brought him 10 years ago, he would have done his year and left. You know, but not anymore. Tulsa is a different place now.
Yeah. Gail, any more?
No. I can't think of any other questions.
Okay.
I've learned a lot.
I'm sure you have.
Anything else you'd like to add, Melanie?
I think, I was trying to think of my illustrious career. No, I mean, I have done some film and stuff like that, but I'm just mainly thinking of Tulsa. Spotlight Theater has now got a children's theater there that I hope people will patronize.
You know, I've seen the banner out front.
Yeah.
Okay.
I live down there.
They do cute shows.
Yeah. So anyway, basically that's my story. I remember you guys have got a painting back here with Crown Drugs.
Uh-huh.
Right there. My grandma, back in the day at 11th and Utica, where Hillcrest is, the parking garage there used to be a Rexall Crown Drug store, and my grandma worked there. So it was just, I don't know.
You wouldn't describe those drug stores because I can remember them.
Really?
Yes.
You can remember the Rexall?
Well, not and that one in particular, yeah. But I remember the counters.
Yeah.
With the stools, and if you you could sit there and turn around and round on the stools.
That was your favorite part.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Turning on the
yeah,
stool.
Banana
yeah.
splits. And when's the last time you ever bought a banana split?
Oh God, not with my weight issues. There's like no. Although that does sound good.
Yeah.
I have one for dinner about once every 2 years.
Oh, a
banana split for dinner.
That sounds wonderful. Oh, my goodness.
Good for the soul.
Okay. Melanie, thank you.
My pleasure.
This has been enlightening, and I really enjoyed it, and I don't know if we need to leave a tip at the door or what. But
cover charge. Thank you for asking me. This is a real honor, so thank you so much. I really appreciate
you
guys.
Well, it's an honor for us, and I'm so glad that we have this to share with the Tulsa Archives.
Good.
Thank
Hot
you.
Dog. Sure. Thank you.